Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Aujourd'hui, les plateformes de formation en réalité virtuelle comme Resil aident les sportifs professionnels et amateurs à s'entraîner pendant qu'ils récupèrent après une blessure. S'entraîner dans le métavers permet aux sportifs blessés de continuer à travailler leur concentration et leur temps de réaction pour pouvoir affiner leurs compétences et reprendre leur sport avec confiance. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast zooming in on the world's political, security and social shifts through the lens of its media.
A complete lack of control of the state and the government.
Conflicting narratives.
They're feeling the impact of this war.
The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nigel Adderley, and at 14 hours GMT on Thursday the 4th of April, these are our main stories. As NATO celebrates its 75th anniversary, Ukraine pleads for more missiles.
I don't want to spoil the birthday party, but my main message today will be Patriots, because saving Ukrainian lives depends on the availability of Patriots.
Myanmar rebel groups carry out drone attacks on key military targets in the capital. Aid agencies have told Israel it must better respect the rules governing the protection of humanitarian workers. Also in this podcast, the former Speaker of the South African Parliament appears in court on corruption charges, and he won $1 million at 15, but a gaming champion talks about why he quit.
I've realised that there is more to life than gaming, and you do grow up and it's not a thing that you can do forever, especially at a high level.
NATO is marking its 75th anniversary today, but it's no time to celebrate, as leaders of the Defence Alliance worry they're not spending enough and not doing enough to prepare for the possibility of a wider war with Russia. NATO's two newest members, Finland and Sweden, joined in direct response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022. At a ceremony in Brussels, the NATO Secretary-General Jens Stoltenberg said the alliance's success came from the interdependence of its North American and European members.
Europe needs America for its security. At the same time, North America also needs Europe. European allies provide world-class militaries, vast intelligence networks, and unique diplomatic leverage, multiplying America's might. I don't believe in America alone, just as I don't believe in Europe alone. I believe in America and Europe together in NATO, because we are stronger and safer together.
The NATO-Ukraine Council has been meeting, and it was joined by the Ukrainian Foreign Minister, Dmytro Kuleba. What does he want from today?
I don't want to spoil the party, but of course my message, the birthday party, but my main message today will be Patriots. Because saving Ukrainian lives, saving Ukrainian economy, saving Ukrainian cities depends on the availability of Patriots and other air defense systems in Ukraine. And we're talking about Patriots because it's the only system that can intercept ballistic missiles. And only in March, Ukraine was hit with 94 ballistic missiles. But providing Patriots depends on allies. They have plenty of them. So this will be my main focus today.
And what about the new member, Finland? Here's the Foreign Minister, Elina Valtonen.
We very much agree with our colleague Kuleba that the need for aid is imminent. It is needed in the short term, in the medium term, and also we need long-term commitments. We feel very strongly that Ukraine is really fighting, obviously not only for their freedom, but for that of all of us.
Mr. Stoltenberg has stressed that the alliance's commitment to helping Ukraine is not in question. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale is in Brussels.
They've had the celebrations earlier today. They had a cake. They had a NATO hymn. They gave speeches where you heard Jens Stoltenberg talking about the importance of America needing to be a partner with Europe and Europe needing to work with America. In other words, America should not go it alone. That's clearly a reference, a fear, I think, that's in Europe about what might happen if Donald Trump is elected a second term. But I think there are two things. There's, first of all, the focus on Ukraine immediately, and that is that even Jens Stoltenberg has admitted that Ukraine hasn't run out of courage, but it is running out of ammunition. So what they can do now, but also the longer term and what some people are calling a Trump-proof plan. So if he did become president and he did withdraw support, military support for Ukraine, that would cause huge problems for Ukraine. And therefore, European allies need to step up. And what Jens Stoltenberg is looking at is creating a fund for 5 years of about 100 billion euros to fund Ukraine's military support for the long term, and also taking over what the US has led at the moment, which is the coordination of the supply of weapons and ammunition to Ukraine. That's often referred to as Ramstein, but getting NATO to be in charge of that and also helping with coordinating the training too that has been done piecemeal by different countries, including the UK. So that's the focus. Now, they're not going to reach an agreement on it here. They're going to discuss it, and then they're hoping that when it comes to the summit, which will mark, with heads of state, the 75th anniversary of NATO in Washington, where that treaty was signed, which has been brought over here, by the way, is on show, flown over here for the first time, that they will then be able, in July, when the summit happens, to agree a long-term plan of support for Ukraine. That is the plan.
The former Prime Minister of the UK, now Foreign Secretary David Cameron, is also in Brussels, and he's been speaking to my colleagues on the BBC's podcast, Ukrainecast. Lucy Hocking started by asking whether there was a realistic prospect of NATO troops getting involved in Ukraine.
What NATO's looking at is a NATO mission for Ukraine, not a NATO mission in Ukraine. It's making sure that we use NATO's architecture to help deliver some of the support that Ukraine needs. But, I mean, fundamentally, I think that we should do everything we can to help Ukraine. That's been Britain's position. And I think it's not escalatory to say we are going to help this independent, sovereign country to fight off an aggressor, and we're going to give it all the help we can in order to do that. And I think as long as you stick to that, it isn't escalation. And I would say Britain's played a really key role, actually, in proving it's not escalatory. Lots of people said, oh, don't give them anti-tank weapons. We did. It wasn't escalation. It was right. Lots of people said, don't give them long-range artillery. We did. It wasn't escalation. It was right. And same with the Storm Shadow missiles. We've helped Ukraine to fight off this illegal aggression.
But you don't see the prospect of boots on the ground, NATO boots on the ground in Ukraine?
No. I think that we don't want to give Putin a target like that. NATO can do lots of things to better coordinate the help we give to Ukraine. But fundamentally, for countries like Britain and all those supporters of Ukraine, this is a question of political will. Do we have the patience? Do we have the will? Are we prepared to give the resources? Now, Britain's case, definitely the answer is yes. We've given over 7 billion. We've trained over 60,000 Ukrainian soldiers in a program that goes back to my time as Prime Minister. We started that in 2014. And, you know, fundamentally, add up all the countries backing Ukraine. We outmatch Russia's GDP by 25 to 1. We've just got to make that difference count.
But for people in Poland and people in the Baltic states, they're really worried now about Russia attacking their countries. What is the plan at NATO and here in Brussels if the war spills over into Europe?
Well, we have Article 5. An attack on one is an attack on all. And those countries are NATO members. And one of the things, actually, I did as Prime Minister when Obama was president, was very visibly station British troops on the eastern flank, just as the Americans very visibly station American troops on the eastern flank. So I remember Obama saying, look, it's very important when Russia looks over the border into the Baltic states. They don't just see Baltic state troops, they see British troops, they see American troops, they see French and German troops. I think that's really, really important.
Is there a bit of an acknowledgement here in Brussels at the moment that the current plan is not working?
There's an acknowledgement that we've got to do more, and particularly those countries that haven't done as much as some should do everything they can.
And you can hear the full interview with David Cameron on Ukrainecast, available today on BBC Sounds. Rebels in Myanmar say they've launched a drone attack on the main military headquarters and an air force base in the capital Naypyidaw. The National Unity Government, which represents the elected administration overthrown in a coup 3 years ago, says it ordered the assault, which involved nearly 30 drones. The military authorities say they shot down seven, although one exploded near the runway, forcing the airport to close temporarily. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head told me the attack was bold, but largely symbolic.
Well, it's certainly the largest and most coordinated drone attack we've seen so far. I mean, just as in Ukraine, drones have become a very important weapon in a very uneven fight in Myanmar. All these various different opposition armed groups have formed and taken up the fight against the military government ever since the peaceful protest movement was crushed 3 years ago. But they've got guns they can pick up. They get a few on the black market. They capture some. They've got a lot more weapons as they've gained territory, but they're massively outgunned. The military has a very powerful air force. It uses a lot against them, and it has an awful lot of armoured vehicles. So the drones are, in some ways, it's the one bit of technology they can get their hands on. And in fact, they make their own drones, as well as bringing in the bits and pieces and the parts over the border from China. And they've been using them quite a bit, mostly as a psychological tool against military bases. You know, when you put a drone over it and drop a bomb, even if it's small, it can really scare the troops. But this was much more ambitious. By going after the capital, Naypyidaw, even though it doesn't appear they've caused a lot of damage, there was one bomb dropped near a runway, it closed the airport for a bit. This isn't an ordinary capital city. This is a symbol of military power. It's a fortress-like capital that was built by the military 15 to 20 years ago precisely to render it invulnerable to a popular uprising. So it's very powerful symbolically for these opposition forces to get this many drones over the capital, and in some cases they appear to have been able to drop their explosives.
And what has been the government response to this?
Well, they're not saying a great deal, except that they're not acknowledging there's been any real damage. There probably hasn't. The drones can't carry very much. You know, these are relatively small drones. The most they can carry is about 30 kilos. They are saying they shot down seven of the drones. Beyond that, I suspect they'll need to figure out how they're going to shape a narrative that makes them look good, because, of course, this shows their vulnerability. I mean, they've lost so much territory in the last few months to advancing opposition forces, armed groups in both the north in Shan State and in the west in Rakhine State. These are the most significant military reverses and defeats ever suffered by the Myanmar military in its history. And now with drones over the actual military citadel, the capital, it looks very bad. And I think they will take some time before they figure out how they're going to present this to their own people in the state-run media.
Jonathan Head. After an Israeli strike in Gaza killed seven humanitarian aid workers, a UN agency says Israel has also struck its convoys in recent weeks. The claims have not been independently verified, but Juliet Toomer from the UN's Relief Agency for Palestinians, UNRWA, said their convoys had been hit at least three times in the last month.
There is a system in place where the United Nations gives quite a lot of detail to the Israeli army on our movements. Despite this, at least on three occasions, UNRWA convoys over the past months have been hit, luckily without casualties.
The aid convoy that was struck was from the World Central Kitchen. Its founder, Jose Andreas, said they'd had clear communication with the Israeli military.
So this was not just a bad luck situation where, we dropped the bomb in the wrong place. This was over 1.5, 1.8 kilometers with a very defined humanitarian convoy that had signs in the top, in the roof, a very colorful logo that we are obviously very proud of, but that's very clear who we are and what we do.
Israel says it was a grave mistake, but the economy minister, Nir Barkat, rejected the allegation that the World Central Kitchen aid convoy had been deliberately targeted.
There's no way in the world that Israel would target people that come to give people aid. That's nonsense. I'm sorry. Give us a bit of respect that we care about those people. And it's the same people that helped Israel. We will never target people like this. I'm sure that there was a mistake done on the way. The Israeli army will interrogate this and give the families of the people that unfortunately were killed all the details. And we want to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Monday's attack was met with worldwide international condemnation, including from the US President Joe Biden. He's due to speak with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu by phone today. There's also pressure on the UK government to suspend arms sales to Israel. More than 600 lawyers warned in a letter that the weapons could be used in violation of international humanitarian law. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yolan Nell.
The drone attack, which killed 7 aid workers, including 3 Britons, has shone a spotlight on the dangers facing relief organisations as they try to avert a man-made famine in Gaza. The UN agency UNRWA told the BBC that 3 of its convoys had come under attack in recent months without casualties, despite coordinating their movements with Israeli forces. Countries whose citizens were killed in Monday's airstrike have voiced strong criticism. Australia's Prime Minister said Israel's explanation for the deaths was not good enough, while Poland said there should be compensation paid to the victims' families. An Israeli report, which Downing Street hasn't confirmed, says that Rishi Sunak warned Mr. Netanyahu that the UK would have to declare Israel in violation of international law if it didn't allow more humanitarian aid into Gaza.
Yolan Nell. Electronic sports, or e-sports, are on the rise, and the industry is projected to grow by $7 billion by 2032. That's the sound of one of the most popular games, Fortnite. But what is the impact of a life lived online? Jaden Ashman won a silver medal and just over $1 million at the 2019 Fortnite World Cup at the age of 15, has been speaking out about the damage that years of gaming did to his health. Lucy Atchison reports.
I couldn't go outside and walk to the shops and stuff. Like, I was just getting out of breath and everything like that.
Jaden says he started competing in esports to prove a point.
Obviously, esports is a pretty new thing, and most people, especially parents and everything, don't really believe in it. So it was nice to be able to prove that it is a real job.
And with his success, he was able to make a huge difference to his mother's life.
Yeah, I bought a house for my mum at 15, so it was really good.
But at what cost?
I was so competitive at it that instead of getting a good routine and looking after my health, I just put all of my energy into playing. At the time, I was under-eating quite a lot. I used to get in the zone and focus like quite a lot when I was playing. So getting my meals in and eating healthy and everything, I just wasn't very good at.
Now he's 20 years old and has taken a step back from his favourite teenage pastime. So what's his advice to young people?
Game in moderation, but also just look after your health at the same time.
Jaden, who was a hero in the esports community, has started sharing footage of his fitness journey online with his followers, encouraging them to step away from the gaming controller and take control of their well-being.
Lucy Atchison. Coming up on this podcast, as veteran hard rockers Kiss sell off their back catalogue for $300 million, we'll hear from co-founder Gene Simmons.
The people who say money is the root of all evil don't understand. It's actually the lack of money that's the root of all evil. If you don't have money, you can't improve anybody else's life.
A building tilting at a crazy angle, almost impossibly, has featured strongly in the picture feeds coming into the BBC here today. It's in Taiwan, after an earthquake struck yesterday, the most powerful for a quarter of a century. Emergency workers say more than 600 people are still trapped. 9 people were killed and more than 1,000 injured. Just before we recorded this podcast, our correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes sent us this update from Hualien near the epicentre.
This is now night number 2 of after the earthquake, and it's just started to rain lightly here in Hualien. Rain will make the efforts to rescue people even harder than they have been, which has been extremely hard already. This is an operation going on around the clock, and it is really an operation that is just going as fast as it can. They're sending teams in, they're bringing teams out. As the teams come out, they bring the injured people out, some of them lightly injured. If they've been more heavily injured, they're taken to hospital by ambulance. But I think what's been really surprising to all of us here today is we thought there were about 100 people trapped up there in the mountains, and that has suddenly jumped to around 650 at around the middle of the day today. And that's been quite a shock to everybody here, because that is a much, much bigger task for the rescue teams to track down where all those people are. That landscape up there is just so, so rugged. I have been up there several times before, and it is one of the most rugged landscapes in Eastern Asia. So, you know, the task facing the rescue teams to get to people is just a very complicated one.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes. Nosiviwe Mapisa Nkakula, South Africa's now former Speaker of Parliament, has been released on bail after appearing in court in Pretoria on corruption offences. She was arrested earlier today after being accused of soliciting bribes in return for awarding contracts during her time as Defence Minister. She resigned as Speaker on Wednesday. I heard more about the case from Jenny Hill, our correspondent in Johannesburg.
This case has dominated headlines here for more than 2 weeks since police officers who were investigating corruption allegations raided her home. She's been under considerable pressure to resign, and she capitulated to that pressure last night, standing down. But as she did so, she insisted that the move was in no way an admission of guilt. She denies any wrongdoing.
And how significant a figure has she been in South African politics?
You'll find her described as a veteran of the African National Congress Party, the ANC, which, of course, has governed South Africa for the last 30 years. You know, she's an older politician. She's been a minister. As Speaker, she was one of the most powerful political figures in the country, actually behind the President, really only third down from Cyril Ramaphosa. So, you know, she's really topped the echelons of that party. And as such, these charges being levelled against her have caused enormous scandal, forcing all sorts of questions about the trustworthiness of, well, the party itself, which has long been dogged by corruption allegations. So it is a really hugely significant moment in South African politics, not least, of course, because this country goes to the polls in a national election at the end of May. So really just weeks away from what polls predict could be a very bruising election for the ANC.
Jenny Hill in Johannesburg. The Nigerian National Youth Service, or NYSC, is a one-year national service program that's mandatory for university graduates. Typically, NYSC students will spend most of the year working in schools, hospitals, or in infrastructure development, usually in remote rural areas far from their homes. But as Nigeria descends further into a kidnapping crisis, many young NYSC recruits are scared they will be targeted along Nigeria's roads. The BBC's Frey Lindsay has been talking to one young recruit who we've called Patience. We voiced over her words to protect her identity.
Patience is a university graduate in her early 20s from the south of Nigeria. Before taking up her main NYSC posting, Patience had to go to a weeks-long orientation camp in central Nigeria. Her mother saw her off as she boarded a bus for the roughly 500-kilometre journey. Although she knew kidnappings had happened on this road, she told me she wasn't nervous. But something did happen.
We heard a gunshot. The driver just stopped, and then they came closer to us and asked everybody to come down from the bus. They made us sit on the floor. Then they asked us to bring out everything we had. They gave us our phones back and told us to phone our guardians and our parents. So then I called my dad.
The kidnappers were looking for a ransom, of course. And because they recognised that Patience was perhaps a bit wealthier than the others, they wanted more money for her release. For some people, they asked 10 to 15 million naira, so around $7,000 to $10,000. But for Patience, they wanted 20 million naira, just over $13,000.
They told my dad that if he didn't pay 20 million naira, they were going to kill me. At the time, I was just crying.
On the other side of that phone call was Desmond, Patience's father, also not his real name.
My daughter called and said they'd been kidnapped and they're asking for ransom. And I asked how much, and he took the phone, this guy, said 20 million. And I said to him, if I had 20 million, you wouldn't find my daughter to kidnap. She'll be flying to the nearest airport and then she'll be, you know, coming to that state with escorts, military escorts. I don't have that kind of money. And he turned off the phone again.
They negotiated for 9 days. Patients spent most of that time sleeping on the ground outside with the other hostages in several locations in the forest. But she was eventually released after Desmond negotiated a ransom he could manage. Dozens of NYSC recruits, like Patience, have been kidnapped along Nigeria's country roads in recent years, with some still in captivity to this day. It's of course not just NYSC corpers who are vulnerable in Nigeria. Kidnapping is at record levels and now threatens people all across the country. But corpers' particular vulnerability comes from being corpers. NYSC recruits are, almost by definition, wealthier than the average. They're Nigeria's middle class and up.
Frey Lindsay. The NYSC and the Nigerian Interior Ministry were asked to comment but did not respond. Analysis shows political action has helped reduce the number of trees being brought down in the tropical forests of Brazil and Colombia, vital to tackling climate change. The study from the University of Maryland and the World Resources Institute says that the election of President Lula da Silva in Brazil led to a 39% fall in logging in the Brazilian Amazon. Our environment correspondent Matt McGrath has more details.
The world saw a big increase in overall tree losses last year, mainly because of unprecedented wildfires in Canada. But researchers say that the deliberate removal of trees in mature tropical forests like the Amazon is far more important when it comes to climate change. That's because these trees contain vast stores of carbon. Last year saw the loss of around 10 football pitches a minute of these tropical trees globally. But in both Brazil and Colombia, there were hopeful signs of progress. Since President Lula returned to office in Brazil, logging fell by more than a third. In Colombia, tree felling was cut in half under President Gustavo Petro Urrego. But clearing trees for agriculture and large-scale wildfires drove record losses in Bolivia, Laos and Nicaragua.
Matt McGrath. Kiss are known for their hard rock anthems and extravagant use of makeup. And they become the latest band to strike a hugely lucrative deal for the rights to their back catalogue. Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons, who founded the rock band in 1973, are believed to have received more than $300 million from the Swedish music investor Pop House Entertainment. Ella Bicknell reports.
What can $300 million buy you?
We will be able to pay our rent.
That's Gene Simmons, also known as The Demon, the bassist and co-frontman for the rock group Kiss. The band have sold their music catalogue, brand name and trademarks, including their black and white face paint look, striking a lucrative deal with Swedish music investor Pop House Entertainment. But they're not the only music artists to sell their work. Just like the wide window. In 2020, Stevie Nicks reportedly sold a majority stake to her back catalogue in a deal worth $100 million.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind.
2 years later, Bob Dylan made upwards of $400 million when he sold the publishing rights to his songs. But now it's Kiss's turn. Gene Simmons says they would only sell the rights to people they trusted.
For any amount of money, we wouldn't get in bed with the wrong folks. The last thing you want after you created the band you always dreamed of putting together, handing it over to somebody for any amount of money, that doesn't work, especially people you don't like. So the best thing about this deal is who we're doing the deal with, about the collaborative nature and about how we've met our newest best friends for the rest of our lives.
Pop House Entertainment was founded by ABBA singer Björn Ulvaeus, who made millions in recent years from their concerts featuring avatars, something that appeals to Simmons to achieve rock and roll immortality.
Taking AI where it's never been before. You know, there's business, and then there's the idea of blowing the socks off your fans. And that's the commitment we get from all the folks. They want to take us into areas we never imagined.
Pop House says it has plans for a movie based on the band's story, an avatar show and a Kiss-themed experience which was already in the works. The financial terms of the deal haven't been made public, but the BBC understands it's worth more than $300 million, an all-time record for a group. And Simmons isn't embarrassed about the sum.
More money is always good. I completely reject the idea that if you work hard, that you shouldn't make more money. The people who should make the most amount of money work the hardest. People say money is the root of all evil. It's actually the lack of money that's the root of all evil.
Ella Bicknell reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Joe McCartney and the producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nigel Adderley. Until next time, goodbye.